Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
John O.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with For King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Welcome to Dadville, and as you hear John clap in the background, this is a big one, folks.
Okay, first of all, before we even start, I know I like you guys because you're using GarageBand.
Oh, yeah.
So I already
well,
know.
Well, it's Logic, but it's like GarageBand's Big Brother.
GarageBand Lite.
GarageBand 2.0 is what it is.
I'm a GarageBand guy. I love GarageBand.
Oh, it is.
Oh, man.
Logic to me is the best. Yeah. I mean, I'm thankful.
Well, Logic's too sophisticated for me, but that's
even Logic. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Respect. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's amazing. I'm not smart enough to do. I have Pro Tools, but I'm just not smart enough.
I hung on to Pro Tools. By the way, we are starting... We've lost half our listeners already.
90% of our listeners.
I was in Pro Tools for like 10 years, and then Logic, during COVID, Logic got me. It was all the loops and all that kind of stuff. Now I'm Logic.
Well, I don't know if you've seen this, John. Like, I feel like in my songwriting part of my life, not my artist part of my life, my songwriting part of my life, 98% of the people I work with are Logic. I mean, like Pro Tools, other than studios.
Right.
Like it's like studio, the legit studio guys are
they're
still
doing Pro Tools. But I'm not kidding. I do not write with anybody that uses Pro Tools.
Yeah. I just use GarageBand because I've been using it ever since it was invented, basically.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I'm good on it. I'm fast and I don't have to get bogged down with
that's
engineering.
The thing. That was the sell for me.
I can put up something, I can get a loop. Here we go.
What got me on Pro Tools is somebody told me that you can import your Logic. They said you can import your Pro Tools shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like,
oh, done.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to learn new shortcuts. I couldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And we just lost the other half of our listeners.
Now even my mom has stopped listening. She's like, that's a bridge too far, Dave. I'm out. That is a bridge too far. Okay, folks, that was just a front. That was a front row seat.
Yeah. That was the pre-intro intro.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pre-intro intro.
Okay. Good.
We're known for that, John. So with us, we have... Are you knighted yet? Can we just call you Sir John Oates?
Yes, you can.
Okay. Let's just speak it into existence.
Feel free.
Feel free. Okay. We're calling
you. As long as you don't call me Sir I'll be all right.
Actually, I've gone by that name numerous times in my life. Okay. So what we do, John, is we start what we call the brag sheet. And once again, this is a significant brag sheet. I don't know that we've had one like this before. Okay. So here we go. This is a little bit like This Is Your Life. So
all right.
Buckle up. Recorded first single, I Need Your Love, in 1966. This is recorded 29 albums with Daryl Hall and sold over 80 million albums.
Let's say it again.
80 million
albums.
Okay.
Gosh. I mean, that's just a couple more than John and I combined. He also wrote many of the top 10 songs they recorded, included Sarah Smile. Y'all might know that one. She's Gone, Out of Touch, You Make My Dreams, I Can't Go for That, Maneater, Adult Education, and many more. The duo has 10 number one records and over 20 top 40 hits, 24 BMI Pop Awards, 14 BMI Millionaire Awards, nominated for 5 Grammy Awards, won 3 American Music Awards for Favorite Pop Group, 10 solo albums on his own, inducted in the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2004, inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014. The duo received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 2016. 2017 released his memoir, Change of Seasons. Latest album, Arkansas, was released in 2018. Also has a single, Disconnected, which I was jamming to earlier as John came in. But I would say, and I'm, you know, most importantly, was the 1965-1966 North Penn High School Section 2 127-pound wrestling champion.
That's right.
That's right.
Okay, so we always ask this, John, and I'm especially fascinated. How do you feel hearing all that? Like, when you hear that, like, what happens?
I'm so impressed with myself at this point that I really don't think I actually need to do this interview. And in fact, I was thinking maybe I should just leave.
Just go.
and everything will be pretty good.
You've graced us enough at this point.
Yeah, sort of most people don't even get this much time. So,
okay.
I mean, that is incredible. I mean, is it? What does it feel like to have that kind of a sheet?
I'm not nostalgic. I don't dwell on it. I don't think about the past too much, to be honest with you. And I'm being totally serious. I like to, I like to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you know what it's like. You guys are creatives. You know what it is. It's like, I feel compelled to keep doing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I like to work. I like to be active, and I like to challenge myself. So for me, it's great. I mean, to be acknowledged and, to have achieved all that stuff is sometimes I'm shocked, to be honest with you, that we were able to do what we did because I don't know if people don't realize it or not, but we made an album every year from 1972 until 1986.
Good.
And toured.
And making an album back in those days was more, that's saying something more than it is now. I mean, now you can kind of make an album with more ease.
Well, yeah, using the technology and stuff like that. No, but you know, it wasn't actually too difficult. We never spent more than 2 months making a record.
Wow.
In fact, I'll tell you a really funny story. Well, I've got a lot of them, but we were at Electric Lady doing, I think it was the Private Eyes album. Mm-hmm. And we did the Private Eyes album. A Foreigner was doing Foreigner 4.
Jeez Louise.
And we did Private Eyes. We went on tour for almost 9 months. We came back to start Big Bam Boom. And, and Foreigner 4, they were still recording.
No.
Yeah, they were still in there recording.
They were still
of course,
in
they sold a lot of records, and they made an amazing album.
Yeah.
We were fast.
But you hear those stories all the time, like Springsteen in the studio just like forever. Yeah. You know what I mean?
We never did that.
Yeah.
We wrote our songs within usually about a month or so, and then and we went in, and we only recorded what was on the album, pretty much. There was hardly any...
there's no B-sides coming out.
Yeah. No, there's no extra songs that were laying around or anything like that.
So this, the songwriter in me, I'm always so fascinated by exactly what you just said. The bands like you guys that could go, okay, it's time to write, and you write, you go and you record it, you go tour, come back.
Like Billy Joel.
It's time to write. Like that. That's right. That is so hard for me to understand because it's, like... Nowadays, you kind of take your time and you build on things. You have little ideas that you let sit and you simmer, and then you kind of return to them. Would that, when y'all would write like that, would you be putting together little pieces of things throughout the tour?
Yeah.
You'd kind of have
constantly.
A little, yeah.
I kept journals, and Daryl's the same way. He's always writing in his journals and doing stuff like that. And then we'd kind of share our ideas. We'd like say, hey, I got this. So check this out. What about this? And then, we'd pull it together. And then once we realized that there was a coherent, direction, then it was easy. Then we would just kind of stick with that.
Yeah.
But we see the thing was, all through those years, we spent so much time together. We were together constantly.
Mm. Yeah.
So we're writing, we're recording, we lived close to each other in the city in New York. So we had the same shared experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Both professionally and personally too. We knew the same people.
Yeah.
Blah, blah. So there's it was just like this, it was pretty seamless for quite some time.
And with those hits, I'm so curious to ask this.
We do need to say, for those listening, we're going to set a timer. This is not going to be the whole time. We got to talk some music
stuff. Get to sit with John Oates and ask these questions? So indulge us, people. But, again.
And all I get is this crappy
bag of it's honestly, it's not even coffee, honestly.
Hey, come on over. I'll give you a bag of coffee beans. So obviously I'm a pretty cheap date at this point.
Right. That's our pitch.
Yeah, okay.
What can we give you? Some coffee.
But the worst part is I came over not even knowing I was getting the coffee.
Yeah, that's right.
And I still came
you
over.
You still came over.
So
that's what we appreciate. That's what we appreciate. Oh, boy, that made me giggle. John and I were talking about this before you came over. When you think about the music that you've been able to be a part of, this isn't something where it's like, man, these are great songs and they really did well. I think this weird and beautiful combination of they are such great songs, but also kind of at the beginning of rock and roll. It's like beginning of pop music in some ways. Like you guys with all these other amazing bands were literally putting the first story of sort of popular music together, right?
Like pretty foundational to what
extremely,
we have
that's,
today.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And so these aren't just like, oh, I know that song. I mean, these are, again, I would say bedrock songs to the thing that is pop music now and rock and roll music. when you're, I mean, when you're writing those kind of songs, any of those you've been a part of, which have been just so substantial, would you feel like, ooh, boy, this one, okay. Like, you know, you're kind of walking around.
Did you have any sense of
that? Yeah, like, this is magic.
Yeah, I mean, I think you always do. You know how it is. You guys are writers. You always sense when there's something, you know, you're onto something special, right?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, and you know, a lot of people criticized us over the years of being like, oh, these guys are like hit makers. You know, they've got this formula. They've got this secret sauce that they're able to just knock them out, you know. But we actually spent as much time on every track on every album that we did as we did. We didn't isolate like Maneater or I Can't Go for That and say, oh, this is probably going to be a single, so let's work on this a little harder.
Wow.
We spent the exact same amount of time on every track. And then we basically left it up to the record company and to radio. You know, radio at the time, it was, you know, it was the big record companies and radio hand in hand, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we left it up to them to sell the music. We just said, look, guys, this is what we did. Here it goes. You pick the ones. And then, you know, they figured out marketing and how they were going to sell it. In fact, we never let anybody from the record company come into our studio when we were recording. Ever.
No way.
Never. They never heard anything until the record was finished. And we would deliver that and the album cover.
That is it. We'd that blows say, my mind because of the hits that y'all had.
Here you go.
Yeah.
No, I know. The whole, compared to the way things have gone, you know, in the big mainstream music business, I know it seems like insane, right? With so many people involved now,
right.
You know, everybody's got an opinion and, you know, an analytics and, you know, whatever it might be. No. We just went in there and recorded, and that was it.
So as far as you personally, I mean, you started playing guitar when you were 6,
yeah.
Right?
I should be a lot better. That's what you want to say.
That's exactly where I was going. Yeah.
I figured you were going there.
No, actually, I started playing piano around the same age, and I feel like the other day I wrote a song that I can't play. I was like, if I had to record this today, I can't record it. And I'm like, that's insane. I've been playing for 35 years, and I can't play this song? No, but my question was, you're a guitarist, singer, songwriter, performer, all these hats that you wear, what if you had to pick like one of that list, what's the one that you're like, but truly at the end of the day, I'm a songwriter, or truly at the end of the day, I'm really a player or whatever. Which one is it?
I like to think of myself as a songwriter. I think it's where it all starts. You guys know that. It's all about, you know, there's a million great players, a million great singers out there, but unless you've got a story and a song to sing and play, you have nothing. I think that's one of the reasons over the years where Daryl and I have always had such amazing bands, because great players like to play great songs, you know, as opposed to just jamming, you know, or whatever. So we've been privileged and really blessed to have these incredible musicians. And even before we had our own band in the 80s, where we had a band that we felt comfortable being in the studio and on the road with, we used studio musicians from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the very beginning, our first albums, you know, we had Bernard Purdy on drums.
Uh-huh.
We had, you know, Richard T and, you know, people like that, you know, I mean, just the, and in, even in the mid 70s when we were out in LA, you know, we had Jeff Porcaro playing, we had Lee Sklar, and, you know, also, you know, all sorts of amazing musicians would always, we'd always have them. And it elevated not only what we did, but, you know, just you make great records with great players.
Yeah. So as y'all are making those records, even then, did you feel like, yes, I'm singing, I'm playing guitar, but what I'm really leaning into is like, we're songwriters and we're putting our songs out to the world. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I think we've always thought of ourselves as songwriters. Mm. But we also, you know, we're also, have both Daryl and I have been on stage since we've been little kids.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we're, you know, we're comfortable across the board, you know, when it comes to that kind of stuff.
When you guys would write these songs, how much, because I find the thing that fascinates me about songwriting duos like the two of y'all, and I think I've seen this with Lennon McCartney after being obsessed with him for the last couple of years, it seemed like they sort of did this weird thing where they lived in a vacuum, and like what they were excited about was what they were inspiring each other. Like, does this make you feel, in a little bit of an eye outside what's going on, but seems like for the most part it was more to amuse each other. It was like, what gets you going, are you feeling this? You know, when you guys would write these songs, how much of a, like, were y'all paying a lot of attention to the current music and where it was going? Was it more just like you would write your things together and it became its own thing? Or was there ever an eye? Because with hits that size, it's just, it's amazing to me that you guys could do it as, it's so broad. That's, it's one of my favorite things about what y'all have done musically is that it's not Blue Edsel. It's not pop. It's not even like kind of super pop, you know, Kiss or whatever, you know, it's like, it's everywhere. And so it's, I'm like, surely y'all had an eye on what was going on, or did you just completely lived in your own space? But it feels like, how would you accomplish such a range of things, you know?
I think we were more influenced by where we were and the experiences that we had on tour than we were by listening to music. In fact, it's kind of funny because my wife's considerably younger than me, and she will always reference things from like the 80s in particular. And she goes, oh, you don't you like it? I said, I don't even know that song. I mean, wow. I never listened to anybody else because I was so wrapped up in what I was doing. And that's all I really cared about.
Wow.
And if I listened to music, I was listening to mixes, or I was listening to, or coming up, trying to recraft the song, or, you know, it was very self-indulgent, and right. It was like our own little universe.
Yes.
But you know, the thing one of the things I'm really most proud of in terms of the body of work, so to speak, is that none of our hits sound like another one.
Yeah.
Not one of the, and that's
exactly,
I think, what you were
right.
kind of
that's
talking
exactly
about.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Every song is completely different.
Yeah.
And you know, there's always that pressure, I think, from the outside, from radio, from the record company. Oh, hey, let's do Rich Girl 2. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
we rejected that. Totally rejected that. And I think that's really unique about our body of work is that they really are, the songs are completely original and they're always different.
It's incredible. I think that's one of the strongest things that y'all have done is not just how good the work is, but that it's so unique. It's just consistently another thing.
Yeah.
It's not like, let's double down. We know, let's kick it up a half a step. Let's just
do it. It's true. It was just one of those things. I mean, when we put a box set together, I guess it was about 10 years ago, and that was a chance for both of us to review and listen to all this stuff.
Wow.
And I was like, and I think we were both shocked. Mm. We were both shocked that we were able to do it. Mm-hmm. And on such a consistent level for so many years.
Yeah.
I mean, we just worked our, you know, look, I never took a break from 1972 until 1986. Not one time. And I never had a life, really. And it was part of the reasons we kind of stopped for a while in the late 80s because I needed to step away. I needed to. And that's when I got remarried. I moved to Colorado, built a house, had a kid. Everything changed, you know, because I needed to have something else in my life other than this constant, you know, hamster wheel of recording, writing, recording, touring, writing. And so to this day, really, I value now the perspective of being able to step outside of that, you know.
Why was that? Why no breaks? Was it?
Well, because we're greedy bastards. I don't know.
I mean, was it?
No,
just...
we're both very AAA, hardworking.
Yeah,
you know, like, you know, it's just compelled to do it.
Yeah.
I mean,
and that's kind of just what you do at that time.
Yeah,
like
I mean,
you, Dave, you and I both have our version of that. I think, like, from 2005 to 2011. I mean, I just never stopped, you know.
When you get on a roll, you don't want it to stop.
That's right.
You know
right.
how it is in the music business. You know, be very reluctant to say no, you know.
Yeah, I mean, right.
Because, well, and you guys are building this huge machine during that time. I mean, you've got people on staff, you've got a record label, you got everybody.
That's another story.
I did a couple shows with Billy Joel a couple years ago, and he, you know, I was asking him about how the shows have been going and all his shows at the Garden and stuff like that. And he's like, you got to feed the elephant, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you guys at that time had the biggest elephant that you could have. You got to feed that thing.
Yeah. And, you know, Billy Joel is kind of similar in a way, in a lot of ways, I think. You know, he was part of the big Columbia machine, you know, mm-hmm. he was cranking out the hits and amazing, prolific writer, you know, and the thing that he's done at the Garden is really brilliant because they're coming to him, you know.
It's incredible.
He's become a tourist attraction in New York City.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's literally it's transcended music, really, mm-hmm. even though his music is good. You know, it's something else. You know, so yeah, I mean, you know, he's pretty amazing. But
what was your parents' relationship with music? Like, Were they all in on what you were doing? Was it like kind of half and half? Was your like dad the one that's like, he's going to go play, honey? And she's like, you know.
No, it was the exact opposite. My mom was a stage mother.
No way.
Uh-huh. Yeah, my mom was very pushy. And she pushed me to, I think my mom just lived kind of, you know, vicariously through my talent. And
you grew up in New York City?
Well, I was born in New York City, and I lived there until I was three or four, and then we moved to Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia, and that's where I grew up. Then, you know, went to Philadelphia and then back to New York.
Yeah.
But no, my mom was, you know, she just, she took me to guitar lessons, voice lessons, you know, took me around. I played all the kids' shows and, you know, played at the Steel Pier and the talent shows, and I did all that stuff. So I was like a child performer, you know. She used to make me wear these white Bucks, these shoes, the white Buck shoes. I don't know if you remember, that's pretty old, but and like a red jacket. So to this day, I never wear red, and I
is scarred.
I am totally scarred. And I remember one time we were playing at this amusement park. It was a beautiful, fun amusement park, and I'm a little kid. I was probably like 6 or 7, and there was this one boy. He had red hair. His name was Dennis Erickson, and he was like an Irish tenor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going way back here.
Oh, this
guys.
Is it.
This is like the almost pre-rock and roll.
Yeah.
So, and I remember I wanted to have an ice cream. And she said, Dennis Erickson's mother doesn't let him eat ice cream before he sings.
Wow.
And I was like,
Dennis Erickson, this guy's killing me.
Hey, man, come on.
This guy, Dennis Erickson.
You look over at, he's eating a salad or something.
He's just crying.
So did was she pushing it, or were you wanting to get on stage?
She was, no. I mean, I had musical talent. I always wanted to, you know, once I, you know, first lesson I had was accordion, because the only music teacher in this little town where we lived in Pennsylvania was an accordion teacher.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Actually, he's the guy that invented the Cordovox.
Wow.
The electric accordion.
Yeah.
And his claim to fame was that he played on the Lawrence Welk show.
Ah, there we go. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, it was Pennsylvania, so it was like German, like Wimpa.
Yeah, right, yeah, right, yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
And so I had this little kitty accordion. It was red. Here again.
I was going to say.
With the red.
There's a theme.
Dave, and move the Keurig machine.
I'm sorry, let me get rid of it. I see now there's a lot of red in the room. I don't want to trigger you.
I was, I took a lesson, and then I put it in the closet, and then the next week I'd go to the lesson, and I'd put it in the closet.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, after a few lessons, you know, he said to her, you know, I don't think he wants to do it. And she said, what do you want to say? I said, I want to play guitar. I want to play guitar. So luckily we transitioned immediately to guitar, and then I never looked back after that.
Yeah.
But she pushed me to do a lot of stuff. I mean, I did some really weird stuff. I mean, I played a Christmas show at an insane asylum.
that was so
frightening.
How old were you then?
Probably the same age, 7, 8.
Oh, my gosh.
And I remember going into, it was in Norristown Insane Asylum, and we did a Christmas show, and there were people in straitjackets, and there were people drooling and yelling.
Oh, my gosh.
And
we
had to sing Christmas songs. No, it's some weird stuff. So, yeah, I did that. That was
oh,
wow.
My gosh.
That was one of my big moments.
Wow.
So, you know, people ask me, do you ever get stage fright? I said, no, not really.
Oh, my God. No. Like, yeah, you don't know. Yeah, yeah.
Not really.
Yeah, yeah.
That was genius on your mother's part. She's like, I'll get all the
break
stage
them early.
Fright out.
Break them early.
Yeah, so.
Holy cow.
Man, I have a story of playing at a wave pool at like a teen night, but that's a much better story.
Were you in the water?
My first single was this like ballad. It's called Beautiful Disaster, and I was playing at this radio event in Boise, Idaho, and it was at a water park. And they were, and it was just me solo. So they had this like, you know, keyboard set up like facing this wave pool. There's like a sea of 14-year-olds, having the time of their life,
yelling,
just
and screaming.
Hormones exploding. And then they're like, okay, at 7, we're gonna shut the wave pool off, and you'll play your song.
Shut the wave pool off.
And I'm like, these kids are gonna hate me.
No, they hate you.
So the
much.
Only thing I could do, I'm like, at the bridge, I'm gonna jump in the water. And they told me, they said, just don't jump in the water. It's like insurance thing. Just don't jump in the water. I'm like, These kids are going to hate. The only chance we have of these kids ever liking the song is if I jump in this water.
And you jumped in the water.
And I jumped in the water.
It's show business, you know?
Yeah.
So what was, were your parents able to see your success? I mean, how did that go?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were always really supportive. They always, you know, helped me with like buying a guitar or an amp or something like that. They, you know, once they realized that there was no turning back, they never pressured me to do anything. They wanted me to go to college, which I did. Mm-hmm. And I graduated from Temple University.
And what did you study in college?
Well, I was a radio, television, and film and journalism major.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Because I always like to write. Writing has always come easy to me, whether it's writing, song, lyric writing, or prose, or what, that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So it was really the path of least resistance. It was like back in those days, it was if you could stay in college, you didn't have to go to Vietnam.
Oh, gosh.
So I had an ulterior motive because my best friend from high school was killed in Vietnam. A number of other my high school friends were killed. So it wasn't really something I really wanted to do.
Right.
So I managed to stay 4 years, and I managed to avoid that, which was lucky for me.
Yeah.
Here again, journalism was just a super easy course. I would play music at night. You know, I played in the clubs, and I played in coffee houses, and I played folk blues, and played in little blues bands and things like that. So, and plus I wanted to be in the city. That's why I went to Temple University.
Yeah.
Because it gave me a chance to be in the city.
Yeah.
And I knew that's where the music was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, yeah.
And you, I mean, you're front row for like, because what's happening in like the folk movement is kind of
everything.
Yeah.
It was one of the greatest times to be in Philadelphia. Philadelphia had not only the Philadelphia Folk Festival, which is, going on 55 years now.
Wow.
So all the great traditional performers, the blues, the folk, they all were being rediscovered in the early 60s. Coming, and Philadelphia was the first folks festival after Newport. So Newport was first and Philadelphia was right there after.
Wow.
So all the great performers, and I got to see everybody.
Wow.
And then of course there were these amazing coffee houses, the Second Fret and the Main Point, where I could see, here again, all the same performers. My guitar teacher and mentor was the road manager for Mississippi, John Hurt.
Wow.
So I'd go over for a guitar lesson and he'd be there.
Oh,
Doc Watson would be sitting on a couch.
No way.
So it was really like this incredible opportunity. Then, on the other side of the coin, the Uptown Theater, which was part of the Chitlin Circuit, the Apollo in New York, the Howard in D.C.
Yep.
This is the R&B circuit. So on Saturday nights, I would go to the Uptown, and I saw all the greats, you name it. I saw Stevie Wonder do Fingertips when he was 12.
God.
I saw James Brown. I saw Otis Redding, The Miracles, Temptations, Sam and Dave, you name it. So there was this, it was just this kind of barrage of stuff, and I loved it all, and I played in a band, and I played some of the R&B stuff, and then I'd play folky stuff in the coffee houses.
Wow.
So, and to this day, that's kind of what I do. I kind of do this combination of this, but to me, it's all the same.
Yeah.
It's this great legacy of American roots music that is just so rich and so unique to America. That's if I can be proud of anything, it's like if I'm a small part of that.
Oh my gosh, for sure.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, of course.
It's American pop music is one of the greatest things that America has ever given to the world. There's no negative, there's nothing bad about it, and it's influenced and spread American culture throughout the entire world.
Yeah.
So if you can be part of that, that's pretty freaking
awesome. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So I said into the mic, John.
Yeah.
Lionel Richie, more like Lionel Pori.
Oh, how did you get on stage at Taylor Swift's show?
Well, I'll tell you how I got in jail later.
Right. Yeah. Well, listen, Dave, great story.
Okay.
As you know, being a dad is a full-time job. And one of the most important parts of that job is making sure your kids are getting the nutrition that they need.
Okay,
right?
John. Yeah, I only know one nutrition/music-related pun. So
give
I figure now is the time I've been waiting really my whole life for.
Yeah.
Here goes.
Okay.
Let us turn up the beats.
Let's just let that linger in the air
for
a little bit. That's too good.
Yeah.
That's too good.
Okay, it's getting a bit smelly, but that's the exact opposite of today's sponsor, Hiya Health, who have invented a pediatrician-approved, superpowered, chewable vitamin.
Superpowers are the best. What's your favorite superpower?
teleportation. You just it's about gas that we just save so much.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's a very dad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen, Hiya Health Superpower is making amazing vitamins that are made with zero sugar, zero gummy junk, yet tastes great.
Yep,
and it's perfect for picky eaters.
Getting my kids to eat anything without complaining would be the most impressive superpower job. We both know that.
We know that.
Hiya's vitamins are formulated with the help of nutritional experts. They are pressed with a blend of 12 organic fruits and veggies, then supercharged with 15 essential vitamins and minerals, including vitamin D, B12, C, zinc, folate, and many others to help support immunity, energy, brain function, mood, concentration, teeth, bones, and more.
That sounds like a full plate of goodness, Dave. Mm-hmm. Hiya is designed for kids of all ages and sent straight to your door so parents have one less thing to worry about. You know, when it comes to kids' vitamins, I just want to set it and forget it.
Oh,
you know?
I get that. I take the same approach to baking a cake. I don't know. But then I have these really acute flashbacks to the episode of Saved by the Bell where Screech swaps the oven knob. Total nightmare. Still wake up. I have nights where I wake up screaming. And anyway, that's too much. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. John,
I'm about to tell them. You can receive 50% off. That's 50% off your first order. And to claim this deal, you got to go to HiyaHealth.com/Dadville.
John, this deal is not available on the regular website.
No, it isn't.
Because
we got
the inside track, right, okay? Dave. We got the scoop over here. Call us Baskin-Robbins. Listen, go to HiyaHealth.com/Dadville. That's HiyaHealth.com/Dadville and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults. So I said, I really would rather not eat the finger foods as I don't really enjoy eating fingers.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't know that you had a bar mitzvah.
Yeah. Speaking of food, John.
Yeah.
What are you making for lunch today?
I'm not sure. You know, I only have 10 minutes to make a great-tasting nutritional meal, you know.
So yeah. What a coincidence. What a coincidence, John. Listen to what I'm about to tell you, okay?
Tell me.
Today's sponsor, Green Chef, is exactly what you're looking for. Just today, you're not going to believe me, but please do. I made a hot honey edamame salad with pineapple, and it was incredible.
In 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Dang.
Yep.
Also, hot honey edamame was the name of your a cappella group in college, right?
It was.
You were unbelievable.
When you started it, I knew you were going to land it. And it's not why I love you, but it's one of the reasons. Listen, Green Chef is a CCOF certified meal kit company. They make eating well easy with plans to fit every lifestyle, whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free, or just looking to eat more balanced meals. And each week, they send you lunches that can be prepared. I know you're not going to believe what I'm about to say, John.
Say it.
10 minutes. That's how long.
It's insane.
Just 10 minutes.
All right, let's see what's on the menu for this week. And Dave, I want you to give the name of an occasion that you would prepare these for.
Okay. I'm just spitball here. Let's go.
Here we go. Kale salad with pork.
After a sword fight.
Pistachio-crusted sockeye salmon.
After watching Ghostbusters 2.
Obviously, yeah. Cajun-spiced chickpea power bowls.
Bench pressing, right after power lift.
And it sounds like Green Chef can cover nearly any get-together at the Barnes Corporate.
It sounds like that to me, too. Yeah. Green Chef has options for every lifestyle. Keto, vegan, vegetarian, fast and fit, which is me, Mediterranean, and gluten-free.
Make time for exciting new goals this spring with our convenient and nutritious recipes. Try fast and fit recipes like Dave, under 750 calories and ready in less than 25 minutes. Plus, cut down on meal prep with pre-portioned and prepped ingredients, including pre-measured sauces, spices, and dressings.
I was making the Thai-style chicken and bell pepper soup last night for Annie, and it was so easy and tasted like takeout. She looked at me and said, "Is this takeout?" And I said, "No."
And then she was like, "Don't take it out of my hands."
Listen to you. The recipes feature premium proteins, seasonal organic produce, and sustainably sourced seafood. Expand your palate with unique farm-fresh ingredients like figs, dates, and artichokes.
I love it. And you know what? We worked out a deal for our Dadville listeners. All you got to do is go to greenchef.com/Dadville60 and use the code Dadville60 to get this, Dave.
No.
You're going to
no.
die. 60% off, plus free shipping.
Now, listen, John, everybody in the street right now that comes to watch us do these is going 60%. And yes.
They don't believe it.
It's 60%.
It's true.
I'm going to greenchef.com/dadville60 and using the code dadville60 to get 60% off plus free shipping.
Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well.
Man,
Dave, I want to give a shout out. And when I give a shout out, I always laugh because it just brings me so much joy to give a shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with free samples.
You know it, John. This time of year, my allergies are in fuego. They're always on the attack, but I use this and you should too.
Oh, I do, Dave. Every day in our house. Yeah. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D.
Designed for serious allergy sufferers, which is me raising my hand, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill to relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better.
This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, and itchy nose and throat and sinus congestion and pressure with ease.
John, I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for a long time, and it's been an absolute life changer. I can go for a run without my eyes watering. I may be crying, but it's not from allergies.
Totally different.
And I can sing without feeling like I have like a big old, let's not even call it a frog. It's like a toad.
It's like a family of toads.
It's a family. It's a turtle.
Yeah.
In my throat.
So, you ready to live life as if you don't have allergies?
Yeah, me.
It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter.
Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
Before we get to dad stuff, like, you know, when you were talking about back in the day when you and Daryl were writing all those songs, like how you were kind of in a vacuum together writing and creating. And I recently just made a rule for myself, like when I, you know, I run a couple times a week, and when I'm running, I typically will listen to podcasts because I just, that's my way of shutting my brain down and listening to just the driest podcast I can. But I have made a rule for myself this year, like no podcasts. I'm only listening to music, and I'm trying to listen to music that I don't know. And just like, you know.
Sure.
And so every time I do, I get ideas. I have like voice memos of me just like almost having a heart attack as I'm running.
Trying to
like,
sing ideas.
Trying to sing my idea. So I the last question I wanted to ask you musically, because I have a million more of them, but what is that the version of that for you? At this point, you're still creating great music. Like, how are you getting your inspiration? Are you still in the vacuum?
No, I'm not. I'm out there in the world now. But I relate exactly to what you're talking about, because when I go off for hikes, in particular, I think it has to do with oxygenating
your
brain.
You know,
you get the endorphins going. You know, and I get all kinds of ideas. So I'm always, I've got the iPhone. You know, you just hit the voice memo. You know, sing a little snippet or something, or a groove, or I relate to that 100%. I don't listen to a lot of music though. I should listen to more. I listen to it when my wife plays it in the house.
Yeah.
And that kind of I was trying to help her. My wife has a young niece who's a singer here in town. And I heard a Judd song just haphazardly, you know, in the background. And then she was looking for a song to do. And I said, why don't you do a version of that, you know, this Judd song? But I would never have thought of that had, you know, it not been playing in the house, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't, but I really don't. I like to listen to talk radio. And that kind of stuff. It just kind of clears me out, you know.
Yes. I found that to be true. John got me on a podcast, but it is funny when so much music is in your life. It's like it's a nice way to just not be.
You just kind of want to go to whatever the other extreme is. I think if your whole world is, if you're a journalist or whatever, like probably music is your escape, and then if music is your whole world, then listening to a dry podcast is your escape.
Well, I'm sure you guys probably feel the same way. I'm gonna put words in your mouth, but don't you know?
Don't contradict me. Yeah, you're right. Totally right.
Hey, I'm freaking John Oates. Don't touch me. No, come on. I'm kidding. No, seriously. I don't think the average person, like if I go to someone's house and they put on music and it's really quiet, but I can hear it, it kind of disturbs me.
Yeah.
Because I can't really hear it, but I know it's there and it's this annoying thing in the background. And I don't think people realize that musicians actually listen to the music. They don't let it just wash over them like, oh, I'm going to be sweeping the garage out and I'm just going to have some music playing in the background.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
To me, it's annoying if I can't hear it.
Yeah.
And then
you can't not engage with it.
I have to listen.
I'm trying to figure out like, what key is this in? I can't quite tell yet.
As a musician, you're probably listening analytically in some sense, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's what I do. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I'm listening to the mix. I'm listening to, you know, what's happening in the track. And blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
You know, so I'm listening for information. You know,
right.
And it kind of, in a way, takes away the pleasure of just letting it wash over you. Yeah. If it's really old music that I know so well, like old R&B or something like that, because
you know it.
It's like baby food or something. But anything else, you know, I have to either I listen to it, and my wife will have it on in the car, but really quiet. And I'm like, it's either off.
Are we doing this or are we not?
Yeah, like exactly.
That thing is, I relate to that so much. Like Annie will laugh at me because I'm like, either let's have it going and let me choose it.
Yeah.
Or let's don't have it on. Because otherwise, someone's talking to me and I'm like, I'm sorry, what did you say?
Right.
But that groove was great. Did you hear that bass line? I'm sorry. No, say what you were
exactly,
saying.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, I think this is a really cool thing about you, and I'm dying to hear sort of the reasoning behind it. But so you decided to take your son, right, on the road for – this is such a cool thing. Like, so he was five weeks old.
5 weeks.
5 weeks old. Mm-hmm. And he was out until 13?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yep.
So that you had him homeschooled and he was just kind of with you on the road.
We did try to, we put him in school early on, preschool and kindergarten into first grade. But there was a community school that was very, you know, progressive. And it was right near where we lived in Colorado. And we told them, hey, look, we're going to be traveling, and they said, yeah, it's okay. You can pull him out. So we pulled, but it got to the certain point where he couldn't keep up.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's when we completely committed to homeschooling. Yeah, we started homeschooling them, you know, early on before homeschooling was quite as popular as it is now. But we did hire my wife started stalking the public library until she found this gal who was pregnant. And she was, I guess she had some students or something, and she was just getting ready to stop teaching in the school.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And my wife like kind of found her and said, hey, I got a job for you. And she asked her if she wouldn't mind being a private tutor. And she loved it because she could stay home. She had her baby. So she was with us through two of her own kids.
No way.
Cool. And she was awesome. And yeah, she was fantastic.
She would just come on the road?
No. She would do it
at home
and give us stuff. And then we were on the road.
We would do it then. I got you.
And, you know, I got lost in second grade math.
I was done.
You know,
no doubt.
But no, she was fantastic, and we did that, and that helped us get through a lot of stuff. But you know, my wife's really, she was very, very sorry because I was married in the 80s. I shouldn't have been, but I was. Got divorced. Luckily, we had no kids. You know, the being on the road with Daryl and the band, it was like a boys' club. You know, we would, you know, and plus, you have to take into the context of the times. Touring in the 70s and the 80s was actually pretty good for the extracurricular activities outside of music. And so when we got to the early 90s, when I met my you know, current wife, and we started talking about all this, you know, I wasn't touring a lot. But she said, hey, look, if you're going on the road, you know, same thing's going to happen. We're going to get divorced or something terrible is going to happen.
Right.
And then once we had a kid, it was like, she said, hey, we're going to do this as a family. We're not doing it at all.
Wow.
I couldn't conceive of being on tour with a family.
Right, right.
I mean, to me, it was like,
You only knew one
version. No, I only knew one version. Yeah. So, but we did it. And it was quite an adjustment. I mean, you know, I basically, we began traveling independently of the band.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and we just basically were on our own tour. I'd get to where we needed to be, however I needed to get there. So there was no more tour buses, no more planes, no more. It was just us. And wow. If I had to be a place, I got there, and, you know. And so, yeah, and so we took our kid to, you know, we did the science museums in every city, and he took him around the world. He's been to Japan multiple times, Europe, Australia, you know, New Zealand. And so he had this incredible experience, but academically it wasn't as sound as it should have been.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we couldn't stay consistent.
Right, right.
But what he got on the, you know, in terms of the experiential level.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the interesting thing, many interesting things, but one of the really interesting things was he grew up around adults.
Yeah.
So he had some friends when we'd go back to Colorado. He had some friends that he still has to this day. But really, he spent 90% of his time with adults.
Wow.
So when he would talk or ask a question, an adult would answer him in a very kind of the way an adult would answer a question. Mm-hmm. Later on, when he finally went to school when he was 13, one of his biggest adjustments was how to deal with kids.
Wow.
Because kids would, I remember he came home from school early on when he first started, and he goes, how come when I ask somebody, the kid goes, cuz. Answer is cuz. What do you mean, cuz? He's like, hey, how do you do this? Well, cuz, you know, what? And he was used to getting an answer from an adult who would actually engage with him. Man, and it really
what threw, a unique situation.
It really threw him, and also he had a hard time keeping up academically in certain ways because he could learn at his own pace when he was homeschooled, and then when he had to get into a structured environment, he had to learn at the pace of the group.
Right.
Wow.
And so that didn't always work for him. So there was some challenges along the way, but you know, he was so mature. I mean, he lived on his own from ninth grade. Straight on. He's never lived at home since ninth grade.
Really?
Wow.
Well, he went to a boarding school. He had to because I was still working.
Yeah.
So once he said, hey, I got to go to a school. I want to be with girls and real kids.
Yeah.
Because more. And I would always joke to him. I said, you don't have to worry about school. I said, look, I get you a black T-shirt and a bunk on the bus. You're good.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Like you're just crew.
He's like, Dad, I'm going to college.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, he had no illusions about show business. Trust me.
One of my questions about that, because I knew that, like Dave said, I knew at 5 weeks you took him on the road and he was homeschooled all that time. And I was curious if that was like, hey, let's give this a try and then we'll see where it goes. Or if it was like it sounds like it was, where it's like, no, this is what we're doing. It's us on the road full on.
Okay. I thought we were going to give it a try.
Right.
My wife had no illusions about that.
Yeah.
No, wow. No, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And we're doing this.
Thank God she did. I mean, I feel like when Amy and I first got married.
My wife's name Amy, too.
That's a great name. I have your wife's name tattooed on my arm. Perfect. FYI. I don't want it to be weird. When we first got married, she came out on the road with my band and I for like the first 6-7 years and then we start having kids and so she doesn't go on the road anymore, but it is like a foundational part of our marriage. If we hadn't done that, there's so much that I do now when I go on the road that she's like, yeah, I've been there, I know that green room, like we don't feel as far apart. And that's such a gift that you gave to your son, that he knows you on that level, you know? He knows everything about the music
that's
world.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we know him. That's why we could be apart. And there's a bond that you can that was created because we spent... I spent every moment in his life together, you know, until he got to a certain point where he left us behind.
And he knows that you can't do the second grade math. He knows that.
Oh, he knows
He's
that.
He's like, Dad, it sounded great tonight. You're a little out of tune on the third tune.
No.
And also...
He didn't want to know about music. He's totally...
He's more in the computers, government world.
He works for a private defense contractor.
So oh, geez.
I actually don't know what he does, but it's...
and we can't say anymore about
it. And every time I ask him, he says, I'm keeping you safe, Dad. So I said, okay.
Okay.
Right, that's fine. So, yeah, he's in a whole other world that's weird.
So this is fascinating to me. He really, like, there was a time in the road where he kind of came to you and went, like, I'm ready to do something else.
Oh, I could tell this story. Okay. I'll tell you the straw that broke the camel's back. Jerry Douglas asked me to do a tour with him called the Jerry Christmas Tour.
Wow.
And it was a Christmas tour.
Only insane asylums.
No, but close. No. It was called the Jerry Christmas Tour, and it was with this amazing band, you know, with Doug Belode on drums and Guthrie Trapp, who I still play with today. And some really great, a young fiddle player who was really young, and this gal, an Irish singer. Anyway, so we did this tour together, doing kind of bluegrass Christmas songs, right? And it was during that tour that he had finally had enough, because everyone was drinking. Jerry has since totally sober. I don't drink, you know, and I was never a big drinker, but you know, it was a lot of drinking, it was a lot of this and that, and it was just this exhausting experience.
Wow.
But the music was great, and I wanted, you know, and Jerry Douglas is one of my heroes, and I wanted to play with him, so I did it because I wanted the experience of doing that. And that was where he said, this is it. This is it for me.
Wow.
He was almost 13. He says, I want to go to a real school. I want to be with kids. I've had enough, you know, no more of this, you know. And so that's what we found, a boarding school that was close to where we lived, and we enrolled him there, and he lived in the dorm, and then that was it.
He went
straight to college.
Well, the wherewithal of a and you said, I mean, he matured quickly because of his environs, at the same time, that's just an insane amount. That's your fault, by the way. That's an insane amount of wherewithal for a 13-year-old boy to go, hey, this has been great. I need some structure, and I want to be around kids. Like, that's really impressive.
Yeah,
he knew it. He knew it, and he knew he couldn't go on, and I knew I couldn't really stop working, because I don't want to stop working. I'm not being selfish. It's just, it's my life. And he understood that, too. So that's...
And he enjoyed the boarding school, and he was cool with...
Yeah, it was okay. It wasn't a great situation, but once he went to college, he went to Virginia Tech, and my wife's family's from Illinois. And my father is, my mom passed away quite a while ago, but my father is still alive and living in Pennsylvania. So, and then he moved to D.C. and we're like, okay. And that's where we made the transition to Nashville, because it just seemed we were closer to everybody. You know, and that's that kind of one of the, in addition to the music, was one of the reasons we came here.
So what was the transition like? You know, like I feel like the maybe more traditional route is that your kids at around that age, 13, they start to separate in little microscopic ways, day to day kind of thing. But you guys had a more extreme sort of, like, he's on the road with you every day, and then he's at boarding school. What was that transition like?
Well, I could sense it. You know, that's, I think it's part of the, that's part of the natural process of, of being a teenager. You know, you start to separate, you become your own person and separate yourself from the family and from, you know, the childhood that you grew up in.
Yeah.
And you have to let that happen. I mean, you can't control that. Yeah. They're going to do it one way or the other. They're either going to rebel and reject you completely, or, you know, you've got to, like, you know, I think, you know, the proudest thing I have of being a dad is that I recognize that he was not ever going to be musical, which I was actually happy about, to be honest with you. And I realized that he was very analytical and very kind of science oriented. So I tried to encourage it, you know. I tried to, you know, give him the tools to help him go in that direction, you know. He built a workshop, and he started doing science experiments and doing all kinds of stuff. He built a I'm bragging on your kids, of course, but he built a plasma reactor when he was 15.
I had a plasma TV when I was 15.
I'm like, so what question can I have about the plasma? How big was it? I don't know.
Tell us about that.
I know nothing about plasma reactors.
Yeah, it was really funny, because I produced a songwriters festival in Aspen, Colorado, and there was this group. I can't remember who they were exactly, but they were part of the festival. They were coming to perform. And when they got there, the one guy said, is he your son? And I said, yeah. He goes, can we see the reactor? I said, what? Because they had seen him on YouTube.
No way.
They were like, they didn't want to know about it. And then nothing about me or the music or anything. They were like, can he show us the reactor? So they all came over to the house to go to the workshop.
No.
So he had to demonstrate the reactor for them.
Like, real quick, crazy. I don't know what a plasma reactor is. What is it?
I could tell you, but John, you go ahead. As I'm Googling.
You guys are funny.
I'm pulling up Wikipedia. That's a great question.
It's kind of a I can't really describe it either. I'm a freaking musician. It has to do with gas. You put gas into a vacuum, and then you you energize it electrically, and the gas becomes like a it's almost like a like the sun. It's like the sun in miniature. It's what makes the sun.
Holy cow.
But
he built one of these things.
He built it in a vacuum in a little tiny. Yeah, yeah.
That's incredible.
What in the world?
It's still on YouTube.
That is crazy. I'm going to
look it up.
Well, you know what, too, I was going to say, in a weird way, maybe not a weird way, but that has to be like kind of a relief for both you and him that he wasn't interested in music. Because you see, and especially live in Nashville, and you with L.A. or New York, you know, you see where like you have a dad who has a lot of success, you know, and that son or daughter wants to do that same thing. And it's just, it's hard not to feel a lot of compassion for that because, you know, you're like, you are following in some just monster footsteps. And
sometimes it can work and sometimes it can't,
you
know,
but I mean, I in a weird way, like I think that would sort of be a relief to me knowing like, okay, they're never going to have to deal with like, oh, you're John's. Okay. Well, yeah. And then, cause immediately the expectations are going to skyrocket knowing there's lineage there.
Yeah. No, I was not disappointed in any way, shape or form that he decided to go on a different route. So that's
did you make him take the plasma reactor to the insane asylum though? Just kind of, just so he could show it there and they could feel kind of,
you guys, if you want a little bit more detail on all this crazy stuff, can I promote my book?
Please do.
I wrote a book in 2017 called A Change of Seasons, and it's an autobiography, it's got a lot of detail on some of these crazy stories in there.
What is it like writing a book like that? Like, is it? I'm so scared I would forget things or I would misplaced memories. I mean, how do you navigate that space? Like, do you sit with Daryl and go, hey, question, played that, was it this year,
there's a the multi-level answer to that. First of all, the first challenge was, if I was going to do it, how can I tell my own personal story when my personal life is so completely involved and intrinsically wrapped up in the Hall & Oates experience?
Yeah, right.
And I can't speak for him.
Right.
I don't want to tell, I can't tell his story.
Right.
Yeah.
On a personal level, even though I know it. So how is I going to do that? I did a series of interviews with a guy.
Oh, wow.
Who was actually from the Philadelphia area. And he was very insightful. He always seemed to know what I wanted to kind of, you know, where I was coming from. And it was over a few years that we did these series of interviews. And he finally said, you know, you've got all these stories. He goes, have you ever considered writing a book? And
I said,
you know, I thought about it, but I've never really made the, you know, took the thing. And he said, well, if you ever want to do it, he goes, I'd like to help you. He goes, I can maybe guide you through the process. So I said, you know what? Let's do it. So he became my co-writer and my editor and my researcher. And as the writing process went on, as I got better at it, because I'd never done anything like this, he became much more of a guide and a researcher. And I used to joke with him. I said, you know, if you ever want to stop writing, you should get a job at the FBI because this guy found stuff that I had. And so to answer your question, what would happen is he would say, hey, in 1972, you were here and you did this and you said blah, 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 blah. And I'd go, what? And then all of a sudden the memories would flow back. So it was like, you know, that technique, I think they call it regressive memory, where they take you back in time. You know, it's like a psychological technique. That's what started happening.
Wow.
So, and then I realized, wait a minute, what a gift. There's stuff that I now remember that I never would have remembered for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. And once it started, it opened up a channel, without sounding too hippy dippy about it, it opened up a channel of these memories that started to come back. And so then I would write it. And then, of course, I had to learn how to write because I could always write, but I didn't realize what needed to be done. So I had to start. So as the process went on, it took about 2 years. As the process went on, I got better and better at writing.
Yeah.
More descriptive, more interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. And then I had to go back and rewrite the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. Because the beginning writing was like kind of flatlining. It was bland. It wasn't, you know, it just didn't have a lot of punch.
Wow.
So, that was an amazing process to go on and on and on. And then I was on tour with Daryl at the time, too. And now I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going through this whole thing. I'm writing all this stuff. And if he doesn't like it, I'm going to have to deal with this,
right?
So what I started doing was I started letting him read everything.
Oh, wow.
Especially, not everything. When it was really about me, then, you know, of course I didn't. But when anything that was about us together or something that may have been Hall & Oates related, I would let him read it. And he kind of signed off on it.
Wow.
Incrementally. And I thought, God, if I write 500 pages and I have to go back and eliminate stuff because he decides that he didn't like it or didn't like the way it was described or whatever. So that was a good thing about it.
Wow.
And so, you know, he had kind of basically incrementally signed off on the whole book before the book was even finished, which was a good thing. And, you know, he made a joke at one point. He said, I'm glad you did it because I don't have to do it.
Yeah.
So
that was cool of you to do that. I mean, you didn't have to do that.
I didn't have to, but I thought if I don't, I'm not going to have a book.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a good chance that, you know, this whole thing's going to implode after all that work.
Well, what's crazy to me about that is, like, you know, thinking that, you know, this is the life, this is your life. And yet, because it is so, I mean, I think that's one of the coolest things about your story. And guys, like, came up when you did in these incredible environments playing music. But, like, and you hear this with Paul McCartney, same with all those guys, where they're like, people are coming and going, did you know you did this? And you're like,
No, I know.
But you know, like this guy would research and come to you and you're like, oh my God, I forgot about that. Or,
and he was great. And he's also an author himself. And he's written a bunch of books, history books and sports books. So he had the experience and he knew how to navigate the world of publishing as well. The book publishing is a completely different animal, which was great too. So it ended up that we went to St. Martin's Press and they accepted the book and they released the book and it became an Amazon bestseller.
That's amazing.
That's great.
So with your son, I'm curious to hear that too, because I'm sure he'd read the book and go, there's much stuff he didn't know. But with him, when was the moment that you felt like he kind of, and it's tricky because he had been on the road with you, but I'm always fascinated with my friends and people I meet like you that play music professionally and have success at it, that when their kids kind of go like, oh, this is like you know what I mean? Like, this is kind of, but I mean, that may have been tricky because he was just always seeing the people.
He's always there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, have you started recording yet?
Oh my God.
Yeah, this is good. Let's get that. Repeat that last question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Sorry.
But so he just, there was never a moment where he kind of sat down and went like, whoa, Dad, like this is, he just saw it all.
He didn't. And I don't even think he read the book either.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
He might have read excerpts or something.
Yeah. He was looking for himself. He was like,
he probably read it and told you he didn't read it.
Well, you know what happens when you write a book like that. The first thing people do is they turn to the back and they go into the appendix to see what page they're mentioned on.
Right.
So,
and then they just flip.
I have a question for you because your son is, you know, in his 20s now.
He's 27,
27. So I have two girls, 7 and 10, and Dave's kids are stair-stepped in between there. So, you know, we have younger kids. Yeah. So I'm always curious when we have dads on who have older kids, like, what's the advice that they would have given themselves? What's the advice you would give yourself as a dad when your son was about, you know, 7 to 11 range? You know, like, what can you remember, like, what you were worried about during that time? What would you tell yourself now?
The one thing I was always reinforced with him, I wanted him to be an independent thinker. And I wanted him to know what he was talking about. So we did a lot of reading. I would always read to him when he was younger. And when we were in the car, I always said, never use a word unless you know what it really means. I was very good being an English major, journalism major. I was kind of conscious of that.
Yeah.
But I said, make sure you know what you're saying, and you know, because once you say it, you've said it. Don't say it unless you actually know what you're talking about.
Wow. Words are powerful.
Yeah, I was very conscious of that, and I really wanted him to be an independent thinker. I kept saying, look it up, make sure you know what is going on. Don't just accept someone's opinion of it or something that you might have heard, you know, in passing. You know, if you really are interested in something, understand it and know it. And I would always challenge him with certain words. You know, he'd use a word, and he'd use it in the wrong way, and I'd say, "Okay, what does it really mean? You don't know what you're talking about." You know, so I was a little bit, you're very strict about that. But other than that, I just wanted him to, be happy.
Yeah.
So,
what is it like having a son that age now? Like, what, you know, that he's grown up and he's living his life and he's doing his thing. What is y'all's relationship like now?
Little kids, little problems. Big kids, big problems. Somebody said that. It's true.
Yeah.
They're always your kid, you know, yeah. In some way, shape, or form. And, you know, he's very super independent. But, you know, you know what I'm learning from him? I'm learning that there's a very serious issue with young people in terms of depression.
Mm-hmm.
And the pressures of social media.
Mm.
It's kind of hard for me as an older person to really understand why it's so important.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to me, if someone on social media slagged me or, you know, which they do frequently, or, you know, if there's some negative thing going on, it's easy for me to ignore it. I don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they really care.
Mm. Yeah.
To them, it's really real.
Mm.
It's this... You know, this kind of, and the pressures that come with that, you know, because he tells me, he's like, "Oh, so-and-so and this and that on, you know, Instagram." I said, "Why do you care? Who cares? Just ignore them." It's something that I don't really understand. It's not that important to me or meaningful to me, but to them, it's really, really meaningful.
Yeah,
that is.
And, you know, and he definitely has his bouts of, you know, he's very secure in who he is, but at the same time, you know, I see there's just a lot of external pressures on this new generation. Now your kids are still pretty young. They're gonna move up into that very quickly,
right.
You know. And also the exposure to the world via the internet is just it's
lightning fast.
It's lightning fast. Yeah. It's scary.
Yeah.
It can be very, you know. Kids can be very knowledgeable and very, you know, they can be exposed to a lot of stuff, both good and bad. You
yeah.
know? So, I mean, I don't envy that. I'm glad I'm not growing up in this environment. So I don't envy you guys in terms of the challenges that you're going to have. But, you know, in the end, you know, you just do your best.
Well, I don't know that I've ever really thought about it in these terms before, but like all the social media, anything that's online, anything that's on the other side of the screen, to us, it's like, well, I remember a lot of life before that even was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like I have it at arm's length.
Well, you guys are, at your age, you are in that place where you can remember the world.
We're kind of like the last ones. Probably.
You are.
Yeah.
You probably are, right?
But to our kids, it's like, well, this is as real as this.
That's right.
It's just
That's
all right. intertwined.
I know. It's frightening. It's scary.
And it's weird, you know, because of what we all do with music, you know, either from writing for someone or, you know, I've kind of got a foot in each because, you know, a lot of people I write with are a lot younger,
right.
you know, and so they live in that space.
Yeah.
And they are, everything is sort of operating on here and, you know, a lot of their life is sort of here. And I have a foot in that and I get it and I spend time on my phone too, but I also am like you, I'm still old enough where I'm like, yeah, who cares, you know,
right.
but it's
right.
weird. And to your point about your son, like I really have had to learn that too. It's just, I've gotten to know some of my younger friends. Like, I'm like, man, this is a big deal. You know, like it may not register at all to me,
right.
but then they feel so different about it, you know? And so I think having kids as young as ours, I mean that, you know, I feel like there's a conversation that I have so much about with our friends with kids our ages. It is just like it's coming and you can see it coming. How does your kid engage the phone and internet and things?
Yeah.
And you see it. It's because it's going to happen. It's just trying to sort of figure out how to approach it in a way that, you know, you're not pretending like it's, you know, thousands
not
of years ago.
Thing.
And like, what's that? We don't know what that is.
Yeah.
We, you know,
yeah.
But at the same, and I think that's what scares me. I had somebody tell me the other day, they're like, you know, and this is so heavy on me because I don't do this well, but like, you're teaching your kid how to use like these things by how you do it. And so, you know, I catch that. I'm like, oh, shoot. Yeah, sorry, bud. Like, what's going on?
I hate you know? Any time I'm on my phone when the kids are in the room. We had a guest on, Kurt Thompson, who said, like, there have been studies that, and I'm botching this, but there have been studies that have been done on even if a phone is in the room, mm-hmm. your kids act somehow differently. There's some, like, they can sense the presence of the connectedness that you have to your phone. I hate all that stuff.
Yeah, it's and I, you know, and taking it to from the artistic perspective, all this new deep fake stuff and the AI stuff that's coming is really
frightening. It freaks me out.
Your kids are going to have that. It's going to be normal.
Yeah.
It's going to be totally accepted and normal. They will just, Now, you know, and what kind of series of challenges and things they're going to have to navigate with that?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what that is. I don't know how we make our way through that.
Yeah, I mean, imagine, you know, your kids are in school and somebody has it out, some kid has it out for them and decides to put their face on a thing and,
right.
and throws it up on a thing and all of a sudden your kid's, you know, robbing a gas station or some crazy
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's some really crazy stuff happening.
Yeah.
So,
it's just hard as a parent to feel, even like you're saying about your son, it's hard to feel prepared. It's hard to know, like, how do you deal with one of those? I'm like, I have no clue. Like, this isn't in the manual.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's all accelerated.
Yeah.
So fast.
Yeah.
You don't even have time to adjust to it.
That's right. And it's already.
And kind of absorb and process it and then figure out how to deal with it. You just have to deal with it immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, have you played around with this AI songwriting stuff?
The guy we had on this morning, we talked about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where you. You know, you just say 4-15 words and make a description of a song, and there this thing writes a song for you.
I just can't. I can't believe that exists. He read Elliot Cherry's his name. He came in and he read a poem that this thing wrote about itself.
Oh my gosh!
And look, it's not Shakespeare, but it's like that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it is.
It was pretty good.
I've never felt like more like Terminator. You know how it was like the end of days? I'm like, oh, great. This is where I like walk in and there's a guy that's like with my wife and he's like, we are married now. And I'm like, okay, whatever you say, mister, please don't hurt me. I love your poems. So we always thank you for your time, first of all.
This has been so great.
We always end with a couple of questions.
Okay.
I'll ask the first of the two. What is the one thing you want your son to know?
That I tried my best.
Mm. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that I was there for him, and I tried my best.
Yeah.
Love that.
All right, last question. This is heavy.
Good. Let's go. Lay it on me.
What do you want your son to say at your funeral?
This is heavy. Shouldn't have eaten all that ice cream.
Hey!
And he'll be wearing a red jacket. And some bucks.
Oh,
those are called
white bucks.
White bucks.
That is amazing. That is amazing. Shouldn't have been. He just slowly approaches this. Guys, thank you for being here. And
he was cooking some cream.
Shouldn't eat all that ice cream. All right, guys, there's a reception. Ice cream reception at the thing. Thank you.